Hello and welcome to Popcorn Optional, your weekly movie podcast. We are back after taking a week off because there was nothing good released last week, and we figured that, hey, we would rather just give you guys good content and not have to bore you guys with whatever came out in August. So this week we're back, though, with a new review of the movie Wind River. I'm Cameron Salinas, and tonight I'm joined by Jake Brown and Trevor Allison.
What up?
Good evening.
We will be doing our normal review this week of Wind River, as previously mentioned. We will also talk news, breaking news that broke a matter of hours ago as of the recording of this podcast. We'll do a new segment of honorable mentions. We'll talk a new trailer that we saw, and then we will get into our content of the week that we are recommending to you. But let's just start off with news that broke literally hours ago, which is that Colin Trevorrow, director of Jurassic World, Safety Not Guaranteed, Book of Henry, is no longer directing Star Wars Episode 9. He has been mutually removed. Thank the Lord. What did you guys, when you guys first heard this, were you like, what was your reaction?
Mine was literally an all caps reaction of thank God. apparently there's been a lot of issues with him and Kathleen Kennedy and just Lucasfilm in general and Disney. And also I'm all for giving great indie directors bigger budgets and bigger projects. But I feel like Jurassic World was successful because it's Jurassic Park and Chris Pratt. Like, it doesn't matter who directs that. People are going to go see it. And Safety Not Guaranteed is a great movie. Like, it's one of my favorite indie films, especially indie sci-fi films of the last 10 years, 15 years. But it's a really small, intimate character study, really. And those are, I'm not going to say those are easy, but the stakes are pretty low in those situations.
It seems that it was kind of doomed from the start in some ways. After the mediocre critical reception of Jurassic World, and then especially Book of Henry bombing in every way imaginable. I think my first thought after I heard this was, well, of course, now which direction are they going? And I think that we may get to learn, depending on when this is announced, just how much Lucasfilm likes Rian Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a good point, is if Rian Johnson's Episode 8 is a hit, he seems to be the only logical choice to still be able to get this movie out on the time scale in which they want to get it out, because this movie was supposed to start shooting, if I'm not mistaken, in like a month. Like, it was going to start shooting before Episode 8 was even released. So Rian Johnson seems to be the only person close enough to kind of pick it up and keep the movie on schedule. Who would be your guys' pick if it wasn't Rian Johnson? Do you guys have directors in mind that you would like to see helm a Star Wars movie?
I'm very pro Rian Johnson taking that project. Super excited to see what he does with 8. But I also would love to see, like, Denis Villeneuve take a chance at that. I think that would be pretty awesome.
Do you think Villeneuve would, I mean, he's doing Blade Runner, but do you think that he would want to step into the Star Wars world? Like, is that,
I think, I don't know. Everybody's like, I think my thing is, it's Star Wars. Like, no one's going to say no to directing a Star Wars film.
Yeah, except for the really pretentious ones. But yeah, for the
except
most
for
part,
Ben Affleck, who did say no.
Yeah, there's some pressure there too. I think that an Alfonso Cuarón Star Wars movie would be interesting, but his style doesn't fit the saga. It would have to be one of the stories.
But I mean, so that's interesting that you bring that up, because Cuarón also did the third Harry Potter film. So,
right.
But that one, like, sticks out compared to the other one. Like, it feels very stylistically different. It's the best.
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely the best, but it feels like a different series almost.
And I also, right. I also feel like that David Yates' style fits the books better than what Cuarón did. Not that Cuarón made a great film, but I think that that it kind of pulls you away. And I think that's the danger of having someone like him. He popped into my mind as someone that would be fun to have this, but it's the danger of having him in a universe that already exists because he does what he does.
Right. Yeah. I think you guys hit it on the head with the pressure. I mean, not only is this a Star Wars film, but if Rian Johnson's Episode 8 ends up being a huge success, whoever comes in has not only the task of following up two very successful Star Wars films, but kind of closing out a trilogy of these films. So whoever takes the reins, good luck to you, but you have a massive task ahead of you.
And the other thing is, with shooting starting soon, who was in charge of the story? Was Trevorrow did he have some input in the story? Is J.J. Abrams still involved? Is Rian Johnson doing something? Like,
Trevorrow and his writing partner, Derek Connolly, who I believe he's worked on every single one of his movies with, were writing the script. And then I don't remember who, but they announced last month that somebody else was coming in to rework the script, which was kind of the first sign of trouble in paradise, I guess. So I think Rian Johnson has had a play in helping craft the story. And obviously Kathleen Kennedy, the head of Lucasfilm in general, has had a part. But I think outside the people that are still involved, Rian Johnson's probably had the closest involvement. I think Abrams is pretty distant from the project right now. Would you guys have any interest in seeing Abrams come back and do Episode 9?
I mean, I think if for some reason you can't get Johnson, I think you back up the truck at J.J. Abrams' house and give him enough money that he puts everything else on hold. I mean, I think I don't know what other options you have with the way that everything
has
happened.
He's the safest option for sure. Like, yeah. You know, J.J. Abrams is going to do good work. He has the respect of everybody in the industry. And he's going to make you a J.J. Abrams sci-fi movie, which is fun and lighthearted and inspiring and pretty. I don't know if he would have the right tone for something like Episode 9. I mean, Episode 9 might be super dark. Who knows? So, I don't know.
Is it weird of me to hope that somebody like Fincher comes in? Like, there's rumors that Fincher might direct World War Z 2. So, I can't think that it's outside of the realm of possibilities that Fincher would be interested in directing a Star Wars film, right? Like, that's not completely illogical.
Once again, it's Star Wars. I think anybody's going to listen to Kathleen Kennedy if they come knocking.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was going to say, Kathleen Kennedy is definitely a number that you answer when they call.
Right. Well, it seems to be a bunch of mix-up at... I saw a tweet earlier. This is what cracked me up was the fact that there have been more directors fired from Star Wars films since Disney took over than more directors that have actually been a part of or that have actually directed Disney films, Disney Star Wars films. So I don't know what that means, but there we go. All righty, let's go ahead. If you guys don't have anything else that you would like to say about the topic at hand.
Nope.
Let's go. Alrighty, we're going to move into another segment of Honorable Mentions. Now, for those of you who don't know, Honorable Mentions is a segment where we induct people into the Mensch Hall of Fame, where these are people that have to hit a certain criteria. And the criteria is that they must have worked on or been in something to the effect of five or more films. And then the big part is, do they pass the blind test? Now, the blind test being, if I knew nothing about this film other than the fact that they were involved, would that be enough to make me want to go see it? Are these people big enough stars, directors, writers that if I didn't know anything about the movie other than, let's say, Steven Spielberg, who is in the first class of inductees, if I knew nothing about a movie other than Spielberg was directing it, would that make me want to go see a movie? That's the big basis for are they a mensch? So let's get into this week's segment of Honorable Mentions. Jake, who is your nominee for Honorable Mentions?
I have a couple options that I could pull from here. I think I'm going to go with this one. So this is a person that more recently has been in the spotlight a bit. but has been kind of a background player in cinema for the last 15 years. But I think he's somebody who is not only one of the most talented actors of his generation, but is also someone who has changed cinema more than probably anybody else who is an actor, for the technical advances that he has brought to cinema. And that person is Andy Serkis.
Mm.
Wow. I knew this day would come where Andy Serkis would be a mensch. I mean, he's the most menschy of menches. He's Gollum, he's Caesar, he's Snoke, he's in Black Panther as well as Ulysses Klaue. I mean, I don't even need to think. He's a mensch. He's for sure a mensch.
Okay.
Trevor. I'll say.
Oh, I should also state that it has to be a unanimous vote for somebody to be a mensch. We all have to say yes. Trevor.
When I first heard this, I was intrigued. I was thinking, I can't place a lot of Andy Serkis going back really far, but as I'm scrolling through his filmography, a couple of things stick out. I mean, of course, his work in the Lord of the Rings films. We've waxed poetic on him in his performance in the Planet of the Apes films. He's fantastic in the Black Panther trailer, so I can only imagine how great he's going to be in the film. Wait, is he also in The Devil Wears Prada? Did I make that up? Is that a thing?
Close. 13 going on 30.
Okay, yeah. Similar timeline, similar feel. He's great in that
He's the best part of that movie as well.
There we go. That was it. Yep. He has those bad sideburns.
I think my argument is, like, not only is he a tremendous actor, and especially recently, anything he's in, I'm intrigued and more willing to go see if he's in it. But what he has done for motion capture, he is the one that brought it to where it is today. And every motion capture film, every motion capture performance in a video game, even most of those are, practices and techniques perfected by him and his studio. So he's literally changed filmmaking.
Yeah. His motion capture stuff is very important. He's also someone who becomes like unrecognizable in his roles. I mean, the motion capture CGI stuff, independent of that, like if you scroll through his photos on IMDb, it doesn't even look like the same person. I think he's kind of come to the forefront, like you said, but I think he's an all-time great character actor. I say yes. I didn't really think of him as really an option, but yeah, he's a mensch.
Boom. I'm always here to keep you guys on your toes. That's my point.
Andy Serkis, welcome to the menches.
It's an honor.
I have to be honest. At first, when you said Andy Serkis, I've been watching The Office, and I thought Andy from The Office, and I was like, ooh, I don't... Oh, wait, no, not that Andy. Okay, different Andy. We should
Andy
also
Bernard,
mention...
Andy Bernard is a mensch. I don't know about Ed Helms, though.
We should also mention that Andy Serkis has his directorial debut coming out later this year in a film called Breathe, starring Andrew Garfield.
Looks like The Theory of Everything.
It literally does. Like every part of it looks like it.
Yep. So, Trevor, what is your nominee for honorable mentions?
Okay, so... I had the first one that I wanted to talk about this week. I'm going to push back because he's a director who has a movie coming out soon. So we're going to wait. But I'm going to talk about someone, and I guess I've got a couple options, because one of them, it kind of depends on how long we have. One of them is a yes all the way around, and it's like not even close. So, maybe we'll skip that one for later. Mine is someone who's been mentioned on this podcast already, and I didn't really plan for it to go this way. I didn't know that Star
Colin
Wars
Trevorrow.
But my oh goodness. I will say, I love Safety Not Guaranteed. I agree with Jake about that. It's great. My person is, and this is, and you can take it in any of his many roles that he carries at all, but my person is J.J. Abrams.
Ooh.
Doesn't have a ton of writing credits, doesn't have a ton of directing credits, does a lot of producing, but kind of pulls the strings in a lot of things, a lot of TV shows, a lot of movies. But in my opinion, he just doesn't make bad things.
Cameron, I'm going to let you go first.
If we talk in terms of movies, he is 5 for 5 in terms of movies that he's directed in my book. Mission Impossible 3, Star Trek, Super 8, Star Trek Into Darkness, Star Wars Force Awakens. All great movies. I would say yes, he's a mensch.
I agree.
Okay,
well, I say yes as well. And I think it, like you said, Trevor, he's a person who seems to be pulling a lot of the strings. He's almost like the Great Wizard Oz, like just the person in the background whose name is on everything. He seems to have his fingers in every project. And everything he touches seems to turn to gold in a weird way. So, yeah, definitely a yes for me.
All righty.
I thought I was going to have to convince you guys a little bit.
He's really
steered the Mission Impossible franchise into like the gold standard of action films in the 21st century.
Yeah.
Like, the films are, they're like the height of ridiculous action cinema.
Three was great after a disastrous 2.
And that was his first time directing a movie. My pick for honorable mentions is a man who I would say is the most unique, one of the most unique and identifiable directors working nowadays. He's a director who, if you see anything of his, you instantly know that's his work. And that's because he's kind of taken things and done them his own ways and made his own, not only story style, but visual style, thematic style, soundtrack. Everything about his films is very unique, and I love everything he's ever done. He's a fantastic director. He is Wes Anderson.
That's where I thought you were going when you started talking about him.
This is an obvious yes.
No one does what he does. I don't know really how else to like put it succinctly, but it's the way that he just creates a full story. This idea of the illusion of reality and just like pulls you into it completely. I think of the amazing set pieces that he uses, like that cross section of the boat and the Life Aquatic. Like that is just like, that's like next level stuff. Like he's amazing.
My favorite thing about him is how he takes things that are just so dumb. Like nobody should care about these stories, but he's able to do them in such a unique way that at the end, it's the most delightful thing you've watched that year, you know? Yeah. Everything he does is just phenomenal. He hasn't made a bad movie yet. And he's made a lot of great movies. And like you said, he has one of the most unique styles ever in Hollywood. So yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. I say like delightful is such a good word. Like Moonrise Kingdom is the single most delightful film I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
It is what you wanted your childhood to be. It's just the way that he does these things, and the way that he crafts these scripts with this just deadpan humor, and the way that he gets his actors to play it too he just does great work.
Yeah. Welcome.
Welcome, Wes Anderson. You are a mensch. I know that's probably a huge honor for somebody like you who, you know, has been nominated for Academy Awards. Anyways, let's move on to trailers. Jake, you saw a trailer this week called The Current War. Tell us about this trailer.
Yeah, this I'd never heard of this. I didn't know this was in production. I haven't seen anything from this. But randomly, the trailer just kind of dropped in my theater. And it was one of those trailers when it was finished, everyone in my theater, you could hear whispering like, oh, that was good. Yeah, that looks good. And it looks really interesting. It has Benedict Cumberbatch and Michael Shannon essentially battling for the future of energy. Is it going to be gas or electric? And basically the current war that happened as the United States built its power grid. And then boom, here comes Nikola Tesla. What up? And it looks really, really good. It looks like it has Oscars written all over it with the performances and it being like a period set piece. And I don't know. I was just very pleasantly surprised by this, having had no knowledge of its existence before the trailer played.
Yeah, it was. I don't think the trailer's online, but it's one of those movies that when you watch the trailer, you're sitting there going, "Wait, who is that?" And then you're like, "Wow, this movie has Benedict Cumberbatch, Michael Shannon, Nicholas Hoult, Catherine Waterston, Tom Holland. I mean, this cast is insane." And I don't know how this movie, at least for people like us who, you know, keep up pretty regularly with movie stuff, I don't know how this movie's kind of flown under the radar.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I don't get, maybe that's their point, or maybe that's what they're trying to do, is they're trying to slowly build and not be like, hey, look what we have. Because that's worked out pretty negatively for movies in years past, you know, Gold being the most recent, Gold and Silence probably being the two most recent examples from last year. But yeah, I think I was pretty impressed by this trailer.
Yeah.
I think it's got a lot to offer, and November 24th, you better believe that they're betting this will be a Oscar contender.
Yeah, it definitely has that feel.
Alrighty. Let's get into our review of Wind River, the new film from Taylor Sheridan, who has written Hell or High Water and Sicario. This is his first time directing a movie. IMDb has the plot as an FBI agent teams with the town's veteran game tracker to investigate a murder that occurred on a Native American reservation. I recently read that this was a finality in Sheridan's American Frontier trilogy, which, if you look at Sicario, Hell or High Water, and Wind River, those three actually kind of complement each other pretty well in terms of the experience, I guess would be the right word, that you get from each of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Jake, what were your general thoughts on Wind River?
I freaking love this movie. This is an amazing piece of filmmaking, both technically and storytelling wise. This is top-notch filmmaking, in my opinion. It's great performances by all involved. In my opinion, this is by far Jeremy Renner's best performance, maybe even award worthy. This is a slow burn that just like flew by for me, and the ending was phenomenal. I only have a few minor complaints. I think the score was a little distracting and off tone. There were some small like editing and continuity mistakes, but it's a small indie picture, so you can excuse that. But otherwise, I have zero complaints about this film. This is near flawless filmmaking from start to finish that brings us into an unknown world of real life tragedy. And basically, I can sum it up by, I will watch anything Taylor Sheridan has a part in the future. He is an honorable mensch. And this is probably my favorite film of the year so far. This is right up my alley. I loved this movie. So yeah, Trevor, what did you think?
I agree with most of what you said. I loved it as well. I just like sat and stared at the credits without even like reading them, because I was just kind of taking it all in. And I thought about Sheridan as a mensch. He hasn't done enough movies to qualify yet.
I mean,
but I'll
put him in. I don't care. I'll fight you guys for it.
He's on the way, definitely. I have not seen Sicario. But following along with Hell or High Water, it's yet another modern Western, but in such a completely different sense than Hell or High Water is.
Mm-hmm.
just this film is beautiful. It is like perfectly sparse. It has exactly what it's what it needs. It doesn't have anything extra. The way the film is shot, the scenery, everything complements. Everything complements the story. Everything pushes the story along. I have a few minor complaints that we'll get into, but I mean, I loved this film. This was a well-acted film. I think that Sheridan really showed that he can direct a film and not just write a great story.
Yeah.
Renner is great. It's either this or Hurt Locker for me and Jeremy Renner performances. This is right there. Elizabeth Olsen is great. Graham Greene is great.
Jonathan Bernthal. What? Hello.
Oh man. Can we, we'll get into John Bernthal, but this guy,
he's
this
in
guy,
the credits. It's not a spoiler. It's on IMDb. Yeah.
Okay.
I honestly had no idea that he was in the movie whatsoever until
I didn't
scene.
Either. Between this and Baby Driver, this guy is the best actor per minute of the year. Like,
yeah.
For the little time that he is, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can't say I was too surprised, but I was intrigued to see what Sheridan would do as a director after having some great stories. And he definitely has matched his ability as a writer with his directing.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. This movie's fantastic. I think this movie thematically is just so tight and so succinct in the story that it's wanting to tell. I mean, this is and the same with Sicario and Hell or High Water. This is a story that's told by somebody who has a vision, knows exactly what they want on screen, and writes that down, and that vision, you know, comes through. I think this movie is just, I've never seen a movie that, this sounds weird, but that respects its audience so much. And I mean that in terms of, this movie doesn't belittle anything. It doesn't dumb down anything. It takes mature, strong, gruesome themes and goes right after them. There's hardly any exposition. And when there is, it's very little. The movie just has this pace to it. That's just, it's fantastic. And there's so many things in this movie that just work perfectly. And I think that Sheridan has just tapped into something in this American Frontier trilogy that's so energetic in such a smart way that, yeah, I'm with you guys. I'll see anything that he's going to be a part of, because he's doing fantastic things right now. Do we want to go ahead and get into spoilers? Because I feel like to talk about a majority of this movie is going to be to get into spoilers.
I think we have to.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, let's go ahead and get into spoilers. If you haven't seen Wind River yet, it's out in a pretty big selection of theaters. I'd be willing to bet that it's playing somewhere close to you. So please go see it. It's fantastic. If you haven't seen Sheridan's other work, go see that as well, because it is well worth the time. Let's go ahead and get into spoilers. Jake, what would you like to talk about?
I think my favorite part about this film is how we as the audience are essentially with Elizabeth Olsen. Like, she is the vessel for the audience, to where we're dropped into this world that very few people know about, which is the Native American reservation world and how the politics and justice system work with that, and just how it's a totally different, almost country within a country. And it's something that I knew very little about, and I love that what you said, Cameron, how Sheridan respects the audience. There is no exposition dump at the beginning. There's no 30-minute long scene to understand the nuances of the tribe and the land and the federal government and the way it interacts. No, it's just, we're just dropped in into this horrible situation with this person who has to figure it out, and we're figuring it out with her. At no point did I think I know what was going to happen. Like, the moment that they revealed what happened to Natalie and Matt, I was like, holy crap, I did not think that's what was going to happen. And the shootout at the end, like, just literally everything that happened, you get the sense that something is going to happen, and then when it happens, it just like punches you in the gut. And you're happy that it did. yeah, I'm over the moon on this film. I really, really liked it. And I feel like I'm just kind of like raving about how much I liked it, not really saying anything that contributes to the conversation. So somebody else should say something.
Yeah, this is truly a film about the plight of the Native American. That's really the core theme of this film in a lot of ways. And it's interesting that it uses two white people as its vehicle to tell this story.
Yeah.
But it's still effective. As someone, I know maybe a little bit more than the average person about what life is like for the Native Americans, mostly owing to my being a social studies teacher in my past. The more that you get into the way that the U.S. government has treated Native Americans, the more you're going to feel sick to your stomach about it.
Not great.
But I mean, this shows, yeah, right? It shows the issues. I mean, the issues of land and governance and law enforcement. I mean, the tribal police chief has six guys for an area the size of Rhode Island. Like, and these are areas that have way more issues than a lot of places in standard America. The way that it depicts the family issues, the drug use issues that are real life things. Like you said, what Sheridan does, he doesn't make movies, or he doesn't necessarily set out to make a movie. He sets out to tell a story, and he tells it in a real way, not in a like, this is how you like edit a story or just include like the cool parts, the fun parts. Like, this is just a story of regular people living their lives, trying to do what they can to get by, what they think is right. And we're just in that along the ride with them.
The statistic on the screen as Corey and Natalie's dad are just sitting there after Natalie's dad almost commits suicide. Just that there's no database for missing women, and no one knows how many there are. Like, I did some more research on the statistics of Native American reservations.
Missing women on Native American reservations.
Right. I did some further research on those statistics just because, like, this film did such a good job at sparking that interest. So a few statistics that'll blow y'all's mind. On the Native American reservation of Wind River, life expectancy is only 49 years old, and unemployment rates are higher than 80%. American Indian women are raped and sexually assaulted at a rate 4 times higher than the national average, and they are 10 times as likely to be murdered than any other American. A white man can come onto a Native American reservation, commit a crime, rape a woman, but he can only be caught within the reservation from reservation police. If he's caught outside of the reservation, unless it is a felony, there's nothing that they can do about it. And sexual assault of a Native American woman by a non-Native American man cannot be prosecuted because it was a state crime on federal land. At the same time, if you are a Native American accused of assaulting a non-Native American, you can be prosecuted twice, once by federal government and once by the tribal police. It's double standard. Yeah. On medieval proportions. It's absurd. I was just going to say, like, and this film just lights that, it just lights that spark to open your eyes to this world while not only giving you that information and making you hungry for more, but by blowing you away with amazing filmmaking and amazing story. And it opens up this empathy to this world that I had no idea existed as a white guy in Texas.
I don't want to get like too far off into the weeds here with regard to this podcast. Cause I mean, there are some really important things going on here. But the way that the United States government has treated Native Americans really since Europeans showed up here is that when it benefits the US government to treat the tribes as sovereign nations, they do that. But when it benefits the U.S. government to treat them as subordinates who are easily conquered, they do that as well. So when you like force them to sign a treaty and move them somewhere, you say, well, they signed the treaty, they're a sovereign nation. Except that your gun was literally in their back while they're doing it. I mean, we see this, the government playing, the U.S. government in a lot of ways playing both sides of this, and to a point where now it's they've been pushed basically to this land where no one wants anyway, so they're just out of the way. So these issues, like you said, are just they're oblivious to those of us who aren't near this, who have no contact with this, who have no way of knowing about this. And I think that's why this film is really an important film, in addition to being an amazingly great film.
Yeah. There's another film. It's a documentary called Damnation, and it'll be part of my recommend this week. But it talks about those same issues of essentially how the United States government cut off Native Americans and reservations and tribes from river access by building dams, and how much that affected their culture. And it's about dams in general, but that's a big part of it. And it is fascinating and terrifying and horrifying. And God bless the USA, right?
I think what you guys are hitting on is one of the best parts about this movie, is that the best movies inspire conversation. And we've spent the past, 10 minutes of this podcast just talking about culture of Native Americans outside of this movie even. And I think that for the movie to inspire that is pretty powerful. And I think this movie deserves all the praise for how it handles the subject and how it presents it within inside the movie. But yeah, it's incredibly powerful. I think you guys have hit on that, and just how much this has inspired you guys to research this topic in general.
I think what Trevor said is interesting to me, about how we're shown this world through the perspective of two white characters, and how I think that's a controversial thing that he did. I think he's probably going to get some backlash on the fact that the heroes of this story are two white people that went to the reservation and did what they needed to do to bring justice and the great white savior and blah, blah, blah. First off, this is based on a true story. So, I mean, take that with a grain of salt. But secondly, I think in a way it acts as a bridge to understanding, because we are with a person who is trying to understand this world and is having the same thoughts and questions that we are, and are then receiving the answers as we are desiring them as well. I think it aids the story, at least the storytelling process, in my opinion. I don't know.
I agree. I think that there are a lot of times in stories like this that attempt to tackle similar themes. There is this kind of white savior complex, this issue with that. But I don't get that from this film. One, Corey, Jeremy Renner's character is, I mean, a well-established part of the community.
Yeah.
It seems. I know that maybe a couple of the characters have an issue with him, but I mean, for the most part, he's a well-respected, well-established member of the community. And then Elizabeth Olsen's character doesn't even come across as a savior-like character. She comes across as like, this is who we had to help you. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
Very, not, very Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's more of a, I think that these particular characters, the way they're crafted, it almost, amplifies that apathy that American culture at large has for Native Americans, instead of them being these grand, wonderful people who come in to do the things that the Native Americans aren't capable of.
Yeah.
That's not the way the characters play this.
I agree. It was handled very well, and I think helped in the storytelling process.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about the acting. The acting is the part where I have the most, I don't even know if it's problems, but I feel like the biggest weakness of the movie at points. And that's not across the board, because like you guys said, I think people like Gil Birmingham and John Bernthal and Elizabeth Olsen are great. There are times, though, where I feel like Jeremy Renner is too stoic, too cowboy in a way. if that makes sense. Did you, I mean, and same, there are lines that his ex-wife, Julia Jones, says that feel very, like, stiff. Was there any point, like, is an acting a problem for you guys in this movie? I kind of just chalked it up to the fact that it was Sheridan's first time directing and being behind the camera in that respect. But was there any pause for you guys in terms of acting at all?
I disagree. I loved his take on it. I don't have a ton of experience with people like this, but I've grown up in a culture of hunters and ranchers and cowboys and had a lot of experience with people like this. And I think what Jeremy Renner did is very much how those people are, of just we put our head down, we survive, we work hard. Life comes at us, it sucks, but you know, we're gonna cowboy up, essentially.
I'm not saying I didn't like his performance.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that there were times where it felt like he was more playing a cowboy than there were in other parts, and those parts were felt very just kind of off. Like it took me out of the film for a second, but luckily the film is so well paced that you're quickly brought back in.
I think a lot of those moments are in moments where there is a lot of emotion on the line, and that is the default state for somebody like that, is to put up that cowboy up mentality, that wall of stoicism, if you will. And then when, say, Elizabeth Olsen is at his cabin and those walls start to come down and emotion is now released, it hits really hard, because this is the first time that we've seen cracks in the walls that he's been putting up in this emotionally draining situation.
Yeah, I think he does a good job of capturing that. He's got that almost look in his eye the whole film of a man who knows the difference between right and wrong, and knows that it's not always the same thing as doing what's legal or illegal. It reminds me of this. If you guys have seen Clint Eastwood in the Man with No Name trilogy, just this kind of it's really a little bit anti-hero-ish of this idea of this man who is, I'm trying to find the words to say this. He knows exactly what's right and what's wrong, but he hasn't always done what's right.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's kind of the feeling that you get from him, especially with the way this film ends in a lot of ways. There's a difference sometimes between being right and being just.
It's also a confidence of he's gone through a lot of stuff and come out on top, kind of like the speech he gives at the end of out here, there is no luck. You just survive. And he's survived through a lot of stuff. And so he has that look in his eye of like what you said, Trevor, which I think could be wisdom. I think that, like, the wisdom of going through the crap that life throws at you, but also just an aura of confidence of, like, I could F you up.
Right. Well, and I think a little bit of the time when it could be that his performance maybe feels flat, I think it's that kind of emptiness that comes around to him when he's lost his daughter and has really no answers as to why or how it happened.
Yeah. It does come off as like an emptiness. That's a really good way to put it.
And I could see where you kind of feel like he's going flat a little bit. I could understand kind of what you're saying there, Cam.
Yeah. It's like I said, there are very few moments, but if I had one complaint about the movie, that would be it. And luckily, I mean, the film, the third act of the film is just so filled with tension and well-paced. And there's the part that I most wanted to talk about was the turn when you realize these guys on the reserve are, something's going on. And, you know, the police are being flanked, and then Elizabeth Olsen goes up to the door, and that scene where she knocks on the door And then you see John Bernthal shaving and walking to the door. But then it's revealed that John Bernthal is not actually Pete, but he's Matt waiting for Natalie the night that all of this went down. I mean, that was just such a nice, like, twist. I was like, the whole entire time, it was like a good movie. But I feel like that twist of that moment made this into a great movie.
Yeah.
And I just, how did that scene work for you guys? Did it work well?
That's how you do a flashback. I mean, it's integrated seamlessly into the film.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's unexpected. It really, it's using the medium of film to its full advantage. The way that scene is told. Whereas if you're reading this in a book, it's like line break chapter.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times I think that sometimes, people when they're making a film, they forget that they're not just telling a story, but they're telling a story through film, and doing something like this, like, really makes use of the medium.
Yeah, it was very Christopher Nolan-y of just like, yep, time doesn't matter right now. But I loved that twist, but the scene that followed was that entire short film doesn't, it is a short film. The scene where Natalie comes in and you are within 2 minutes. Like, we know at the beginning, Natalie is dead. Like, that's not a spoiler. It's literally the first scene in the movie. And all of this time, right, you're just hearing about who Natalie is, and she's on screen performing for maybe like 2 minutes. And in those 2 minutes, like, you find her incredibly endearing. Same with her boyfriend, Matt, John Bernthal, who we didn't even know was in this movie and is an incredible actor. Like, those two, the writing, the performances, like, you're rooting for them. And then the moment you realize what's about to happen, even though they've only been on screen for a few minutes, it just kills you. Like, it's just perfect writing, perfect directing, perfect performances. And it's a terribly brutal scene. Like, It pulls,
oh gosh,
no punches. I could feel the people around me like sinking into their chairs as what was happening was happening. And yeah, it was rough and it sucks, but it was that's powerful filmmaking. That's incredible for everybody in the theater to have that feeling and to be able to do that scene the way they did. And then it gives enormous weight to what's about to take place, which is it hits the fan, essentially.
Yeah. And I think, Jake, what you've hit on there is the fact, like, how much chemistry is built between these two characters in a matter of seconds. And even though we know what's happening, like you said, it's like, it doesn't, like, it makes it even more heart-wrenching, and it makes, like, that's how you do a scene like that to drive story and not just to have it in there to make your film gritty, but having, you know, a rape scene in a movie to drive the story instead of just putting it in there for the sake of putting it in there, which is what
Game of Thrones does.
I feel like so many storytellers do nowadays is just a crutch to get you to care about characters. And this movie actually makes you feel that, like, hurt and pain, and that John Bernthal would be willing to do anything for her. And he does in that moment. And just, oh man, that film is just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
What makes what Sheridan has done. And I hate to ignore, the name of the director from Hell or High Water. It's David McKenzie. Because he definitely played a role in this too, but something this had in common with Hell or High Water is the way that it depicts violence is whatever the opposite of gratuitous is. It doesn't glorify it. It's such a, like, a neutral take on violence. It's just like, here, this is why it happens. And it explains its violence. No one is, like, inexplicably violent in these stories, especially in this film. It's just there's a reason behind these motivations. And it's, like I said, it's, I don't know what the opposite of gratuitous is in this sense, but that's what the violence is.
You feel the weight of violence in these films. Like, yeah, only like seven people die in this film. But I mean, every death is just like so matter of fact. Is like, you're right, Trevor. I can't think of the word that would describe what it is, but like when it happens, you feel the weight of death. You feel the weight of murder.
It's so matter of fact.
Yeah. A lot of films and culture these days almost glorifies violence or diminishes it to just something that happens. Whereas this is, it shows the catalyst and the consequences of violence.
And I think what helps that is the audio editing. The sound of Corey's gun,
dude, holy cow,
is that like that brings so much weight to what was going on in that situation. I mean, not just his, but specifically the sound of those shots ringing out with no other noise.
That one shot that ripped through the wall and like threw that guy across the trailer.
Yes,
dude.
Yeah,
that was, yeah. I mean, guns are no joke, y'all. Safety first.
for real.
Safety not guaranteed.
Hey-o.
Look out.
Bring it round circle.
Also, while we're on that scene, I do want to say real quick, because we haven't talked about him yet, but the performance that James Jordan gives as Pete is remarkable.
Yeah.
He is just like, the way that he like kind of embodies this evil almost, in the trailer and throughout that scene, until he's finally just completely broken by Corey on the top of that mountain with his feet turning blue. The work that he does in a short time is fantastic.
Also, Graham Greene as Ben, the tribal police chief, he was phenomenal. I think every performance in this was perfect, all the way down to the smallest characters.
Trevor, that scene at the end with Pete, James Jordan, like in that moment, you were made incredibly aware of the difference between a warrior and a coward. And that scene brings it so full circle, because you fully understand how much of a warrior Natalie is and how much of a coward this guy Pete is. Just in terms of how they handle their environment. And it's such a powerful statement to make in such a simple way, that that's one of those, the part that sat with me like ever since I've seen this movie is the line where Jeremy Renner's like, however far you think she ran farther. And it comes to find out, you know, at the end, that it's like, she ran 6 miles barefoot through the snow in the middle of the night and then finally collapsed. Whereas Pete makes it, what, like 100 feet and dies?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is, it's interesting because rarely do we see ultimate justice. Like this is like in some way, like the truest form of justice possible.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can struggle with feeling good about it. I kind of struggle with the morality of ultimate justice. But I mean, Pete definitely got exactly what he deserved.
Yeah. And that's, that scene at the end with Martin and Corey, just sitting there, and there's that just understanding and respect and thankfulness. I don't know if that's the right word, but, yeah, that scene is just so powerful because you fully understand where both of those men are sitting. And I think that that's another thing that Sheridan did so well, was making you throughout the course of the movie understand the weight of that moment. Even if you've never lost a loved one, you in that moment understand at least a sliver of what they're going through.
That scene earlier at Martin's house with Corey and Elizabeth Olsen and Jeremy Renner and the Indian
man,
that was hard to watch. That was powerful. But I want to throw it back really quick to the final scene with Pete. So when Jeremy Renner said run, I thought he was going to wait for a little bit and then shoot him, like target practice or something. I don't know. I feel like a lot of filmmakers would have done that of the justice that Corey is imbuing on this man, essentially. But instead, this is the justice of the world that they live in, which is a miserably freezing cold environment. And I don't know, that really stuck with me of like that decision for the character to do that. And I don't know, that was the moment where I was like, Taylor Sheridan is the man. Like that was a good decision as a filmmaker, screenwriter, director. Yeah, I love this movie.
Yep. Well, let's go ahead and get to our ratings for the movie Wind River. Jake, what would you give this movie?
I really want to give this movie an A+. But I can't because of some like editing errors, and I did not like the score. It felt distracting at points. Like at every time the score would start, it sounded like this Sigur Rós song. And I was expecting it to hit this like one note, but it didn't hit that note. And then I was very aware that it didn't hit that note because the beginning of each song is very much a Sigur Rós song. I will find it and we will tweet it to prove that I am not crazy.
All right. So you don't believe that Nick Cave and Warren Ellis are the score masters of the modern Western? Because they also did Hell or High Water. They did The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which is a great soundtrack, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember Hell or High Water's soundtrack very much, but this one really kind of took me out of the film. And for that reason,
I think it was up and down.
Yeah.
So I understand.
Yeah. There were just some moments where I was like, wouldn't have done that. So for that reason, I give this a 96.49. It is as close as you could possibly be to rounding up to an A+. But, you know, just statistically, you're not there. Whatever number I just said, that's what I give it. Trevor, what about you?
All right, so I'm not sure. I guess this was maybe, I think this was like the weirdest direction for the new Avengers movie to go, but I'm kind of cool with it. So that's going to affect my grade a little bit, I think. No, I'm just kidding. This movie is not perfect, but it is great. I think it's a truly great film. I think that I'll say this. It should be a Best Picture nominee. If it's not, that's going to be a travesty. I think there were a couple things. I didn't like how they set up Corey's son and then we just left him alone and didn't go back to him at all. I know the story didn't necessarily take us there, but that was kind of an interesting, kind of a weird feeling for me thinking back on the film. I also, out of respect for the content of this film, I couldn't really think of a silly grade that I usually give. So, I'm going to give this one a solid A, right around where you were saying, Jake, in the kind of mid to upper 90, upper 90 range. I had different issues with you, a different issues than you, but a few small issues, still a great, great film.
Upper 90. This film is a hell of a kicker. I mean, it's just upper 90, every single penalty kick.
That's right. Untouchable.
I'm surprised nobody's brought up how many Twilight alumni were in this film. I think there's four.
Yeah.
Just so everybody's aware, in case you haven't seen the.
I think Will Forte's scene by scene explanation from Parks and Rec is more enjoyable than watching Twilight.
I would agree. Okay, I'm with you guys. This is an A, solid film. It's great filmmaking. We need more movies like this. I mean, this movie cost $11 million to make, and it's already doubled its budget. And I have a feeling that once more buzz gets out, and if this movie is nominated for a Best Picture, that it will get even more box office revenue, and so I'm in for a Taylor Sheridan Western film like this every year, and I think he's on to something pretty special.
My theater was packed. So, was your guys' theater packed?
There were like 7 people in mine.
Mine was okay. Like 25%, but I saw it like midday on Labor Day. Like I saw it 10:15. Okay.
I saw it at like 2 p.m. on Labor Day in downtown Fort Worth. So granted, maybe there's denser population there. I don't know. But out of like 40 seats, yeah, I would say 30 were filled. It was full.
That is good to hear. Let's go ahead and get into our content of the week. Jake, what is your content of the week?
Before I get to content of the week, though, I want to do a little tangent here. And Cameron, I think you can comment on your experience as well. I used MoviePass to see this film. And it was awesome.
Yeah.
Because it didn't cost me anything, minus the $10 a month that I pay. And I just used the app and checked in when I got to the theater. And the guy started talking about MoviePass. I just wanted to see what he thought about it. AMC apparently is not a fan, which I don't understand because they're getting full ticket price and now people are just going to spend that disposable income on concessions. So pull the stick out of your butt, AMC, and embrace this because this is awesome. I guess that's Jake's rant for the week. But I am a huge fan of MoviePass. Clearly this won't work for like opening night of Star Wars or something, but for stuff like this is, yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. Jake, how much was your ticket?
It probably would have been like $8. I didn't even look.
Yeah. Mine. Yeah. And that's the, so here's the hard thing is that anytime that you see a movie that's 3D or IMAX or Cinemark XD or whatever, it's not going to work. But I can only think of a fair amount of movies that I would want to see in those formats.
Same.
And so for people like us who see 4 movies a month, at least, you know, this is going to save us $30 just on movies alone and could save us even more.
Yeah. And I was thrown off by the whole screening personally.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So do I.
I was thrown off by the whole like checking in once you get to the theater. Like you have to check in on your phone, and then when you check in on your phone, it allows you to buy the ticket with your card. That seems like an unnecessary hassle, but
I think it's
an easier way for them to collect data on where you're going and when.
I think that's the big thing. They have to do that to load the debit card with the exact ticket price because you have to be at the theater. And I think that they reference what the ticket price is for that specific showing. And
so that way you can't use the card somewhere else that's not a movie theater?
Yes. It has to be a participating theater. And you have to be on the property or within GPS like recognition of the property so they can verify that that's the showing you're going to and blah, blah, blah. And then they load that exact amount with tax and everything included onto your card.
That makes a lot more sense. Okay.
There you
go. Yeah, overall, great experience. I didn't have to pay for my movie this week and I'm already $8.25 out of $9.99 towards paying off that card.
Yeah,
so
my card hasn't arrived yet.
Well,
Trevor, are you one of the people that whose card was delayed because of the influx of people trying to get to the site?
I believe that I was. I checked on it. I think I got in like the day after you guys. I checked on mine yesterday or the day before, and it said that my card is on its way.
Yay.
So whatever that means.
Yay.
So hopefully it'll be here for this weekend's movie.
But I've been using a gift card that my mother-in-law gave me to buy my movie tickets anyway.
Boom.
So there we go.
Way to go, mother-in-law.
Shout out to her.
Shout out. Okay, but content of the week. I apologize for that distraction. First off, my first piece of content of the week is for anybody that for some reason listens to this stupid show. To donate to the Houston Food Bank or the Red Cross or something, because what's happening down there is insane. And I lived in Houston for 3 years, and it's like just mind-blowing to see what's happening there, like on streets that I would drive every single day. And this is a long battle, and a lot of times, like, there's a influx of giving the first month or so, and then it just kind of dies off, but they're going to be recovering for a very long time. So that's my first content of the week. Second content of the week. the film Damnation. I mentioned it earlier. It's on Netflix. It is about America's reliance on hydropower in like the early to mid 1900s and how that has basically ruined our ecosystem and the rivers and how that's affected people all across the country, including Native Americans. Third piece of content of the week that I recommend is a Netflix series of documentaries called Abstract, The Art of Design. If you are interested in all at all in doing creative work, I highly recommend this as it's very, very high quality produced documentaries about masters of their craft, all the way from photography to shoe designers to car designers to graphic designers, illustrators, stage designers. It's just really well done and very, very informing and entertaining. So yeah, check those out. Trevor, what about you?
All right, so I kind of mentioned a little bit Cormac McCarthy earlier, and our conversation didn't really go that way, so I didn't get into Cormac McCarthy a ton, but I think it's pretty clear that Taylor Sheridan is influenced by the work of Cormac McCarthy, whether it be his books or the films that have been made from his books, including but not limited to The Road, No Country for Old Men, All the Pretty Horses, and the what I believe to be his masterpiece, Blood Meridian, as yet not made into a movie because it's graphically violent and no one can really work out how to do it. But I'm gonna recommend a couple Cormac McCarthy things. The book, like I just said, Blood Meridian, one of the great works of American literature of the last 50 years. It's hard to get into, I'll give you that, because he doesn't like using punctuation. There's basically only periods and there's no quotation marks, so you got to figure it out. But once you get into it, you can actually kind of read it, and it's really good and really interesting. And then I'm going to recommend a film based on a Cormac McCarthy book, and that is No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Directed by our good friends, the Coen brothers. And
honorable mentions.
That's right, honorable mentions. And it includes truly top-notch performances from Josh Brolin and a terrifyingly sparse acting performance by Javier Bardem, one of the most evil characters you'll ever see in film. I think if you like Wind River, you'll like No Country for Old Men if you haven't seen it. If you have, check out anything written and or directed by Cormac McCarthy. Written and or based on a story by Cormac McCarthy.
Awesome. My recommendation for this week is a HBO documentary series called The Jinx. I think this came out like 2 years ago, and I don't want to give too much away, but the ending of this documentary is the most shocking and satisfying ending to a true crime documentary series ever. Satisfying in a horrifying way. But yeah, so that's The Jinx. Also, if you haven't seen Taylor Sheridan's previous work, Sicario, Hell or High Water, please go check those out as well, because those are awesome and are some of the best films from the years in which they came out. That's all we have for this week. If you liked listening to us tonight, please share us with a friend. We would love to know your thoughts as well, so please go to Twitter. Send us a tweet. We're at Popcorn Optional. You can also find us on Facebook if you prefer that use of social media. We're at Popcorn Optional there as well. My name is Cameron Slaney. You can find me on Twitter at 321CamiTime. Jake, where can we find you online?
My name is Jake Brown. You can find my website or my Instagram at jakebrown.tv. Trevor?
I am on Twitter and Instagram at TurboTrevor. I also do, I guess, most of the tweeting and Facebooking for Popcorn Optional.
Awesome. Well, that's all we have this week. Next week, we will be back with our review of the movie It, I'm guessing.
Yes.
I think this is the most mixed I've been excited-wise about a movie since we started doing this podcast.
Cameron, we'll see it
together. Excited
and
terrified.
I'll hold your hand. It'll be okay.
Okay.
But who will see it with me?
Your mother-in-law.
That seems unlikely.
There we go. Alrighty. Well, we have enjoyed talking movies tonight. So until next week, pop, pop.
Whoa. Wait a minute. What just happened?
Magnum is in the building.
My body was not ready for that one.
Ha 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 ha.
Okay, bye.
All righty, guys. Well, bye-bye.